Hey everybody, Charlie Kirk here. Are you new to investing and have savings you need to protect? Right now, the Middle East war, the Ukraine war, and maybe Taiwan soon. You need a playbook that is safe. Allocate some gold right now. Shield your savings with Noble Gold Investments IRA. Go to noblegoldinvestments.com. When fear reigns, gold protects the wise. Noble Gold Investments offers a free 5-ounce America Beautiful coin with new IRAs this month. Go to noblegoldinvestments.com right now. noblegoldinvestments.com, the only gold company I trust. Hey, everybody. It's the Charlie Kirk Show. Raheem Kassam and Brendan O'Neill. We talk about Trump, DeSantis, Nikki Haley, Ireland. So many topics we cover in this episode. Get involved with Turning Point USA at tpusa.com. Attend America Fest, everybody. Amfest.com, December 16, 17, 18, 19 in Phoenix, Arizona. Tucker Carlson, Patrick Bet, David, Candace Owens, Glenn Beck, Rob Schneider, Roseanne Barr, Steve Bannon, and more. Check out the list of speakers and secure your ticket at amfest.com, amfest.com. Email us, as always, freedom@charliekirk.com, and subscribe to our podcast. Open up your podcast app and type in Charlie Kirk Show. Buckle up, everybody. Here we go.
Charlie, what you've done is incredible here.
Maybe Charlie Kirk is on the college campus.
I want you to know we are lucky to have Charlie Kirk.
Charlie Kirk's running the White House, folks.
I want to thank Charlie. He's an incredible guy. His spirit, his love of this country. He's done an amazing job building one of the most powerful youth organizations ever created, Turning Point USA.
We will not embrace the ideas that have destroyed countries, destroyed lives, and we are going to fight for freedom on campuses across the country. That's why we are here.
Brought to you by the loan experts I trust, Andrew and Todd at Sierra Pacific Mortgage at andrewandtodd.com. Joining us now is the legendary Raheem Kassam, who lands more Trump interviews than anybody else. Congratulations, Raheem. It's like, if I want to see what Trump has to think, he just calls Raheem on the plane or in the office. So you're doing a great job. Raheem, there's a lot going on in the Western world right now. We have Ireland that is bubbling up, and we have a lot happening domestically as well. So I want to ask here, just have you walk us through, how do you see the Republican race, Republican primary race, Koch brothers behind Nikki Haley? What are we supposed to make of that?
Well, and thank you for having me, Charlie, and thank you for the kind words. The first thing that comes to mind when you look at Koch World, Koch Network, choosing to endorse Nikki Haley is obviously the mega bucks, right? That's a war chest that any candidate would love to get their hands on any side. Historically, the Kochs have poured hundreds of millions into races over the last couple of years alone, probably runs into much more than that over the last 20-odd years. And the second part of it that people need to understand is that so many people that are in the DeSantis camp actually have worked for or with Koch-aligned and affiliated organizations over their political histories. So, for instance, if you take Ken Cuccinelli had received, when he was AG, a large amount of money from Koch Networks. You have DeSantis' spokesman, Carly Acheson, who was defending her former boss, Governor Kevin Stitt, taking money from Koch Networks previously. And Christina Pushaw as well, the spokesman for Ron DeSantis, the rapid response spokesman for Ron DeSantis, has also worked closely with Koch Network. So you've got to look at it in from that perspective as to why they find it so much of a humiliation, so much of a snub that organization, Americans for Prosperity, and probably the broader Koch Network as well, is now going to be supporting somebody else. Somebody else who has been eating Team DeSantis's lunch for a couple of weeks now, who is fundraising just as much as them, who is going up in the polls, not down or flatlining. I'm not a huge Nikki Haley fan by any stretch of the imagination, but her campaign is clearly more disciplined. She's clearly impressing donors much more. And yes, they are, I've never been a fan of the Koch networks. They are more open borders, more globalist types, more corporate types. But at the same time, like I said at the very beginning, these candidates would kill to get their hands on that kind of money.
So Nikki gets the endorsement and the capital behind it. The Kochs are increasingly sympathetic to DEI, CRT, open borders, more globalist. The DeSantis campaign, it seems to be kind of falling apart right now. And I'm personally quite upset by how we're continuing this kind of unnecessary primary when we should be consolidating support behind Donald Trump. How do you, Ron DeSantis still has about $70 to $80 million that we know of in the super PAC, probably less than that. And it's all coming down to Iowa. Vander Plaats and also Reynolds have endorsed DeSantis. My fear is that Trump will win Iowa, but he might win by 10 or 15 or 20. And the media is going to try to make this to seem like, oh, he narrowly or by a much closer margin than anticipated. Your thoughts, Raheem?
Yeah, I have many. Vander Plaats has been soliciting money from politicians for as long as anybody can remember in exchange for his endorsement. So that's one thing that people need to understand. This is not the big honking snub to Donald Trump that Team DeSantis is trying to portray it as. Strictly speaking, the DeSantis team was willing to cut him a check, and so they got the endorsement. Kim Reynolds is now the second least popular governor in the country. That's a story that we had up over the last couple of days as well when you look at the data. So that's not, you know, Team DeSantis is wondering, oh, well, she's endorsed us and Bob's endorsed us. Why aren't we going up in the polls? Well, if people bothered, if they had actually bothered to try and look at what motivates ordinary people, what's motivating Iowans at the moment, they would know that it isn't somebody else telling them what to do, right? It's them making up their own minds about which candidate best reflects their values and which candidate critically can beat Joe Biden. You know, it's funny talking about the Koch endorsement. Because over the last several months, Team DeSantis has signaled over and over again that taking money from globalist donors, Bush-connected donors, all of this stuff doesn't mean anything because Ron will not kowtow to the donors' demands. He's happy to take their money, but he won't do what they say. And now as soon as somebody snubs them and gives the money to Nikki Haley, they're like, oh, well, she's obviously massively compromised and so on and so forth. This is the type of campaign they've run, Charlie. They've run a campaign where it's so fundamentally out of step with even the things that they are signaling and the things that they are saying that it doesn't ring true to anybody. And I listen, at the beginning of this whole thing, I really hoped we'd see a fair fight. But they came out of the blocks screaming blue murder, screaming all sorts of falsehoods about Donald Trump and Donald Trump supporters, by the way, me being one of those. Who, you know, they've told lie after lie. Oh, you take money from the Trump camp. Oh, you're in this country illegally. You know, just saying all this nasty stuff. And people watch it and they go, well, who are these people? Who are these people who have come along very recently, by the way, into conservative world and are now telling us that the people who have been fighting on the front lines for a decade in the populist nationalist movement are somehow phonies and grifters and what have you. So you've, I look at it through that lens. Obviously, it's very personal to me because I've been doing this for so very long. And I look at it through that lens. The other thing that I think you have to think about when it comes to Iowa, and I agree with you, by the way, this is why we did a story earlier this week about the number of caucus commitments that each side has. So the Trump camp is saying they've got over 50,000 caucus commitments. The DeSantis camp say they've got about 30,000 caucus commitments. Well, that probably will end up with being a closer outcome in Iowa than most people think. And I'm happy to say that because Jeff Rowe's ability, you know, he did the Ted Cruz stuff out there in 2016. His ability in that one state alone on the caucus stuff alone is actually quite good on everything else, as we've seen. He doesn't know diddly squat about running a campaign. So Iowa, yes, you're right. The media will probably try and come out and say, oh, Trump didn't win it as much as he should have won it by. But at the same time, it really doesn't matter. At that point, Ron is going to have a very hard time justifying even staying in the race.
Yeah, and it's going to be also incumbent on us setting the narrative here, because I'm afraid that the margins of the poll show Trump's up 40 in Iowa. I doubt he's going to win by 40 because the caucus system is very tricky. Also, a lot of people enter open-minded. And then the way the caucus works, I actually went to a caucus in 2016, is that everyone sits in like a library or whatever, and they sit there, and every campaign then gives a chance to give a speech. They have a surrogate that will then be able to give a speech. And people then make their decision. They write it on a little piece of paper and they put it in a bucket, right? Probably more secure than our elections in other parts of the country, to be perfectly honest with you. And that's it. That and then they tally it up and then they zap it back in and you'll have a result within a couple hours, right? There's no ballot. There's actually no ballots. There's no signature verification. It's very neighborhood. It's very, very close together. Then wouldn't it be smart for those of us that want to see Trump win to manage expectations going into Iowa? We must remember Trump did not win Iowa in 2016.
Yeah, the answer is yes. And the, also the other thing is, why did Trump not win Iowa in 2016? Because Jeff Rowe in the Ted Cruz campaign at the time told a brazen lie during that caucus, right? About other candidates dropping out, and that you weren't, you know, there was no point in wasting your time, you know, dealing with them. So yes, I completely agree with you. Expectation management is the name of the game going into December, into January.
With the world quickly descending into chaos, the next medical crisis is just around the corner. Whether it's another pandemic or something closer to home, preparedness is no longer an option, it's a necessity. That's where the wellness company comes in. From something innocent and natural like a tick bite to COVID, to the next bioweapon manufactured in a lab, the wellness company's medical emergency kit is what you need to be prepared. It contains life-saving medications like ivermectin, emergency antibiotics, a Z-Pack, and more, as well as a guidebook to aid in the use of these life-saving medications. The wellness company and their doctors, including Dr. Peter McCullough, Dr. James Thorpe, Dr. Harvey Reich, Dr. Drew Pinsky, and Dr. Robert Seek, and more, are medical professionals that you can trust. Rest assured knowing that you're ready for whatever the globalists throw at us next. To order this kit, which I use and I have ready at disposal, everybody, I'm not here to give medical advice, but it is the gold standard, twc.health/charlie. That is twc.health/charlie. Enter promo code Charlie for 10% off. It contains life-saving medications like ivermectin, emergency antibiotics, Z-Pack, and more. The wellness company and their licensed doctors are medical professionals. You could trust their medical emergency kits. They are the gold standard to keep you safe. Again, that is twc.health/charlie. Promo code Charlie for 10% off. See site for details. Prescription may be required. Again, ivermectin, emergency antibiotics, there's all sorts of nonsense going around right now. COVID, RSV, flu. Go to twc.health/charlie, promo code Charlie, wellness company and their doctors. Check it out. See site for details. Raheem, so many stories happening here. I want to ask you about this Deutsche Bank thing. This has kind of been below the surface. Trump did a Truth Social post on it. What are the facts here?
Yeah, Charlie, incredibly important story coming out of the testimony yesterday from New York. The claims that have long been made in this case are that Donald Trump somehow defrauded everybody, right? The public, the banks, you know, everybody you can possibly imagine by inflating values of certain things, misreporting certain other things. And, you know, the defense has pretty much rested on the case that, like, hey, listen, when it comes to valuations of properties, especially in a very fluctuating market, in fluctuating economic times, with somebody whose name on a building alone can change the value of that building quite drastically, that, of course, opinions are going to differ on these things. But here's the crux of the matter. Nobody was defrauded, and you know nobody was defrauded because A, nobody made a complaint of being defrauded. B, everybody that was supposed to be paid for the loans that were taken out by the Trump organization over, you know, number of decades were repaid in full, and we were very happy with that business, so much so that they came back as repeat business partners with the Trump organization. And then C is that actually, of course, the most famous part of the case that a lot of people know now is that it's been the work of Judge Engoron, his staff, Alison Greenfield, and the AG's office that has actually been the ones who have been wrongly valuing a lot of Donald Trump's properties over the years. So what we heard yesterday was that Deutsche Bank saying, actually, you know, in their own words, one of their own managing partners getting up there and saying, there's no problem with the client and us having a different valuation of a property. That happens normally. That happens actually more often than not. He also made it very clear that, you know, while Deutsche Bank throughout those years lowered their estimation of Donald Trump's total wealth, that they didn't change his ability to service those loans. They had successful business dealings with him in the past, so they wanted to do more with him in the future. And they didn't regard anything in those financial statements or any claims over the valuations of any of the properties to be, you know, farcical even, let alone fraudulent. And so this is a critical part of the case, which I personally believe, me reading it myself, that if I heard that as a judge, I would say, well, okay, hold on a minute now here. There's nobody been harmed. There's no actual claim, you know, legal claim here. You know, case dismissed. Everybody go back to living their day-to-day lives. But as we know, you know, Judge Engoron and especially his far-left staff members were closely linked with people like Dan Goldman, who ran the first impeachment, with obviously Letitia James's office themselves. They're not going to end the case there. This is a show trial. It is made simply to take up Donald Trump's time, to take up Donald Trump's money, and to try and land him some negative press. The good news about it all, as you know, Charlie, is I think in the long run, this only serves to help him.
So that's a good transition. We have 2 minutes left here, Raheem. I'm a little worried that there isn't a game plan or a war room of how we're going to navigate the coming lawfare. We're told that there is a trial coming in January. Not only is it Iowa caucus season, but we're talking about trials in January. Raheem, how are you analyzing and strategizing how we're going to go through what's going to be the spring of the lawfare? It never should happen. It's anti-American. It's unconstitutional. But I think we need to prep our base for the looming just hurricane of nonsense. I don't know if we've done a good enough job of fortifying our defenses. Raheem, your thoughts?
Not at all. I mean, not at all. Not have we just not done a good enough job? We haven't done a job. You know, the political right on both sides of the Atlantic is what we're seeing now going on in Ireland, what we're seeing going on in the United Kingdom is always overwhelmed and never prepared. You know, it comes back to the first topic that we talked about. You know, the money from the ostensible right, let's say, you know, the Koch network counts within that. They at least count as the ostensible right here in Washington, D.C., not that that really means anything. But places like that are happy to fritter millions, tens of millions of dollars away on things like that. Meanwhile, right, the information war, we're always playing catch up on. We're always rebutting other articles and other things that are being said. We're always reacting to the assertions that are made on Morning Joe or something like that. We're not actually developing the cases ourselves. It's been incredibly difficult to follow these trials alone and get ahead of these stories, even the Deutsche Bank story, which the media has tried to suppress. As you say, we go into the spring, we're going to need a whole lot more. We need more resources, quite frankly. I mean, that's why, you know, the National Pulse, we have a completely 100% user-funded thing. We don't sell ads or anything like that. We're not in hock to any corporates, any billionaires or anything like that. But my attitude towards people would be like saying this, you know, of course, I mean, unfortunately, we don't have Project Veritas anymore, but we need more organizations like that doing real news.
Raheem, excellent work. Hope to see you soon. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Charlie. Cheers.
Hey, everybody. Mike Lindell has a passion to help you get the best sleep of your life. He didn't stop at the pillow. Mike Lindell has created the Giza Dream bed sheets. These sheets look and feel great, which means an even better night's sleep, which is crucial for your overall health. Mike found the world's best cotton called Giza. It's ultra soft and breathable, but extremely durable. Mike's Giza sheets come with a 60-day money-back guarantee and a 10-year warranty. Mike's latest incredible deal is the sale of the year. For a limited time, you'll receive 50% off the Giza Dream Sheets, marking prices down as low as $29.98, depending on the size. Go to MyPillow.com, promo code Kirk. That is MyPillow.com, promo code Kirk, including the MyPillow 2.0 mattress topper, MyPillow kitchen towel sets, and so much more. Call 800-875-0425. Or go to MyPillow.com, use promo code Kirk, MyPillow.com, promo code Kirk. Joining us now is Brendan O'Neill, chief political writer at Spiked Online. He is English, but of Irish descent. Very important piece that he wrote at Spiked Online. Ireland and the Fury of the Cancelled. Last night's chaos in Dublin was a morbid symptom of Europe's decaying technocracy. Lots to discuss. Brendan, welcome to the program. For those in our audience that are not aware, walk us through all the events that unfolded in Ireland in the last week.
On the 23rd of November at around 1:30 in the afternoon, a man stabbed three kids outside a school in Dublin and also one of their care workers. One of the kids was very, very badly injured. The others were injured to a lesser degree. It turns out that this man is around 49 years old, I think. He's of Algerian descent, so he's an immigrant to Ireland, even though he's a naturalized citizen in Ireland as well. And when ordinary people in Dublin found out about this, they were horrified. They were shocked at the attack on Irish kids. And they went onto the streets. They started rioting. They started fighting with the Irish police. And there was looting. And O'Connell Street in central Dublin, a street I have walked down many, many times, was set on fire, effectively. It was the worst rioting in Dublin in a very long time. So shocking scenes from Ireland. And it really suggests that all is not well in the Irish Republic right now.
So I've been to Ireland before. It's a beautiful country. It's also somewhat of a sleepy country. And I mean that nicely. I mean, it's not a place like the French where it's known for its activism or its, you know, political outrage in the streets. This seemed to be a straw that broke the camel's back. We know that 20% of Ireland is now foreign-born. Walk us through some of the history and some of the background of how we got here, how Ireland allowed so many foreigners and third worlders into the beautiful country of Ireland.
You know, Ireland's immigration statistics are extraordinary. And I think a lot of people outside Ireland don't realize just how extraordinary they are. So as you've said there, 20% of people in Ireland were born outside of Ireland. That's one in five people. Now, to give you a sense of how extraordinary that is, during the great melting pot era in the United States, from the late 1800s to the early 1900s, the period in which we all talk about America as the great country of immigrants, around that time, between 14 and 16% of people in America were born outside of America. So Ireland now has a higher proportion of immigrants than America did in its great immigration period. This is really stunning stuff. It's amazing. And Ireland is not a country of mass immigration. Ireland is a country of mass emigration. That's how people like me ended up in London and people like me end up in America and Australia. But it's not a country of mass immigration. This is very unusual. This is very new. And people aren't allowed to talk about it. When they talk about it and raise questions, they are demonized. They are referred to as bigots. If they march on the streets of Dublin to raise questions about mass immigration, as they have done, they are attacked by the police. They are demonized by the president of Ireland, who referred to them as bigots earlier this year. So I saw the riot on the 23rd of November as really the fury of the cancelled, the rage of the left behind, of people who feel like they've been overlooked. Because if you close down every avenue of expression to ordinary people, eventually it's going to reach a boiling point.
So just walk me through then, where did this come from? Was there a radical Marxist infiltration of the institutions in Ireland over the last couple decades? Because something here doesn't necessarily fit. It's so suicidal. It's so not in the best interest. And Ireland is a country with a very distinct national identity, with a rich history, with a tough history, as you've mentioned, because of outward emigration, but a very proud people, a people that have a history despite all of the headwinds and the difficulties and the famines. Where did the ideological cancer come from that has consumed the whole nation to basically say, if you disagree with us committing suicide, you're a bigot?
Well, you know, the first thing I think to really recognize is what has caused people to feel angry. And, you know, there have been numerous violent events over the past couple of years that I think have pushed people over the edge. So there was the murder of Aislinn Murphy, a very young school teacher who was murdered in County Offaly. It turned out that her killer was a man from Slovakia. In Sligo last year, two gay men were killed, murdered. One of them was decapitated. A third gay man was very seriously injured in an attempted murder. And those three attacks, those two murders and the further attack were carried out by a man from Iraq, who was proven to have a violent homophobic hatred for gay people. That's why he attacked these three gay men in Sligo. And now we have the attack in Dublin where an Algerian man attacked three school kids. It's really important for people to understand how unusual events like this are in a country like Ireland. Ireland is a small country. It's a country predominantly of tight-knit communities. It's still a very rural country. Where my parents come from in the west of Ireland is fairly typical. It's a small town. Everyone knows everyone else. Everyone stops and talks in the street when they walk by each other. It's not, you know, in a crowded city like London and some cities in America, It is sadly not unknown for random acts of violence like that to occur. But in Ireland, it's very unusual. And that really pushed people over the edge. And what people are now asking is exactly the question you've raised, Charlie, which is why has our political class allowed this to happen? I think it's partly because the Taoiseach, the leader of Ireland, Leo Varadkar, is very much in hock to the European Union. And of course, the European Union puts pressure on its member states to accept a certain number of migrants, to accept the ideology of freedom of movement. It's also because immigration has become a way for the chattering classes in Ireland to morally distinguish themselves from ordinary people. Immigration has become a tool through which they signal their virtue and say, we're open-minded, we're good people, we're anti-racist, we love people from all around the world, as a way of saying we're better than the rest of you. So immigration has been weaponized by both the European Union and the Dublin establishment itself. And ordinary people, I think, have been pushed to boiling point on this question.
Yeah, and the radicalism we're seeing from some of the people. I want to just play this here. 52, the Irish Prime Minister Leo Varadkar, which doesn't sound like an Irish name, maybe I'm wrong, is telling you not to connect crime with migration. Play cut 52.
The terrible events that occurred on Parnell Square on Thursday, you know, I really would ask people to try and avoid connecting crime with migration. It's not right. Yes, of course, people who are migrants might commit crimes, just as people who aren't commit crimes.
Where does that come from? That, I mean, we see it in the left as well. In America as well. It seems to be consuming the entire West. And so Leo Varadkar, whatever, said that the government is very white and vowed to make the institutions more diverse. This comes after the government blamed riots following an immigrant stabbing little kids on hooligans driven by far-right ideology, let in over 120,000 foreigners last year, targeting the police force, the defense forces, the education sector. Ireland is over 94% white. So I have a couple thoughts. Do they justify this through economic stimulus, saying that we need to try to improve our economy and that this helps the people of Cork and Dublin and low-wage jobs? Is that one of the ways that they try to pitch this to the Irish?
That is one of the ways they try to pitch it. It's very unconvincing. A lot of immigrants benefit from the state resources of Ireland. They can claim certain benefits, for example. They can have housing. It is being reported that the man who carried out the stabbing in Dublin is someone who has benefited from state resources and state welfare for quite some time. So sometimes immigrants contribute to the country of Ireland and the economy. Of course they do. If you go to Dublin, you will see immigrants working in shops, working in hotels, in hospitality. They do a good job and they do contribute to the economy. But there are other immigrants who come to Ireland who don't. And that's a fact of life. And people in Ireland ought to have the liberty to talk about that and to raise questions about the wisdom of inviting so many people into the country. As to why they're doing it, I think, yes, they justify it as a form of economic stimulus. They also use it, as I was saying earlier, as a form of political virtue signaling. You know, we are good, decent members of the European Union. And like the rest of the European Union, we are open to immigration. So there's that element of it as well. But I think there's so much gaslighting coming from Leo Varadkar and the rest of the government in Dublin, because they now say that anyone who criticizes mass immigration is a racist and a member of the far right and a bigot. And that is simply not the case. I know lots of people in Ireland who are liberal or left wing or maybe centrist, who increasingly feel uncomfortable with a lack of debate about immigration in Ireland, the lack of honesty about immigration, and the lack of ability for ordinary people to raise questions about this policy. So he's wrong to damn people as far right. And I think that's throwing petrol onto the fire of people's anger.
Yeah, I want to keep on diving into this. I mean, there's a lot of descendants of the Irish in America. So it's very interesting to a lot of Americans here, obviously. This is something I would expect out of Germany that has just been beat into submission to have this sort of multi-generational guilt. Like, you know, we'll keep on taking your foreigners as long as you stop blaming us. I don't expect it out of Ireland. And it's really been interesting to see how some European countries like Hungary and Poland say, no, we're not going to do this, you know, importation of the third world thing. And other countries, in a very perplexing way, like Ireland being one, not the only one, like Scotland being another one, the United Kingdom, just say, come on in. We have no national identity. For years, we've been talking about how our nation's public schools have been captured by progressive ideologues. They teach things that directly contradict the values of millions of Americans. That's especially true if you are a Christian family. For those of you worried about the best educational path for your kids and grandkids, I'm pleased to announce our new partnership with the folks at the Herzog Foundation. They are the trusted source on American K-12 private education, with a remarkable suite of resources for parents and grandparents thinking about making the switch from public schools to a Christian education, and for those already in Christian schools too. From their online publication, The Lion, to their new podcast, Making the Leap, the Herzog Foundation offers a wide range of advice and information for Christian parents to make the best education decisions for your kids. To learn more about how your family, faith, and community can flourish through a quality Christian education, go to HerzogFoundation.com. That is HerzogFoundation.com. The Herzog Foundation offers a wide range of advice and information for you. Go to HerzogFoundation.com. That is HerzogFoundation.com. They're the trusted source of American K-12 private education, and they also partner with us at Turning Point Academy. So check it out right now, HerzogFoundation.com. So, Brendan, just kind of covering Europe in general, we're seeing this a little bit, not just Europe, but the Western world. You see it a little bit in Argentina, a little bit in the Netherlands. You're seeing a building rejection of the elements of mass migration, technocracy, an overly centralized Brussels type, Strasbourg type governing elite. Walk us through from a European perspective what you're noticing and witnessing here. What are the main drivers of this political realignment?
Yeah, I think there's a populist revolt taking place around the Western world. I personally find it very exciting and very important. I like to think that we Brits were kind of at the forefront of it when we voted for Brexit in 2016. We voted to break away from the European Union, which was an earthquake in Western politics. You know, Britain, alongside France and Germany, was the key member of the EU. And we kind of set the ball rolling, really, on a populist spirit that has gripped many parts of Europe. We've seen the rise of Giorgia Meloni in Italy. We've seen the success of the Sweden Democrats in Sweden, which is a party that criticizes immigration. You mentioned Geert Wilders most recently, his surprise victory in the Netherlands. You know, what's really interesting, and I think some of your listeners may not be aware of this, is that actually people in Ireland beat us to the punch, because in the 2000s, in 2001, the Irish people voted against the Nice Treaty, which was a treaty to expand the power of the EU. And in 2007, they voted against the Lisbon Treaty, which was another attempt to expand the power of the EU. In both cases, they were ignored and forced to vote again, which created a lot of animus in Ireland towards the European Union. So I think one of the great ironies about Ireland is that the political class there doesn't realize that even its own population, who they think are just a bunch of idiots, that's how they treat them, even they are skeptical of the growing technocratic power of the EU. And even they have flirted with the populist ideals that we've seen growing up over the past couple of decades. So I think what's happening in Europe is that working class communities in particular, working class voters, the left behind, the people who are ignored, the kind of people who in the United States formed the backbone of the vote for Donald Trump, they have risen up and said, we're sick of being ignored. We're sick of being treated like trash. We're sick of being gaslit and censored and demeaned. And we're going to stand up for ourselves and vote for a different way of doing politics. And they've tried that in Ireland and it failed. And I think they may well try it again because the establishment there is behaving incredibly badly.
Yeah. And I think there is a Western, there's Western themes here of pushing back against the overly centralized World Economic Forum-esque type governing model. I need to play this tape here because it's so extraordinary. It's cut 77. The Irish government expects the big tech companies to do censoring for them. It's amazing. Play cut 77.
Spoke to a detective in Pierce Street on Saturday who was actively engaged with the social media companies throughout Thursday, who was actively engaged with TikTok, actively engaged with Meta, so Instagram and Facebook, who was actively engaged with Twitter or X. She said very clearly that social media companies, in particular TikTok and Meta, they were responding, they were engaging with Gardaí, and they were taking down these vile posts as they came up. X were not. They didn't engage. They did not fulfil their own community standards. And that is why we are moving to a situation where these companies do not get to self-monitor. That's why Commission the Man has been established, to make sure that these companies are held responsible, because while some were responsible, others were not. So let me reassure you, Gardaí were seized of this. They were engaging. They were engaging directly with the social media companies.
They just expect mass censorship.
It's absolutely staggering to me that she can be proud that the police were engaging with social media, which basically means the police were putting pressure on social media to censor certain people. That is the beginnings of a police state. When you have the police directly demanding that certain people's posts be taken down and certain people's voices be silenced, that is the beginning of a form of Stalinism. And this is how serious the crisis in Ireland has become, where the government feels more contempt for its own people and their freeborn liberties than it does for the man who carried out that wicked attack outside of school. It really is quite repulsive.
Brendan, excellent work. Thank you so much. You're welcome anytime. God bless you. Thank you. Thanks so much for listening, everybody. Email us, as always, freedom@charliekirk.com. Thanks so much for listening. God bless.
For more on many of these stories and news you can trust, go to charliekirk.com.
Turbulent times call for clear-headed insight. That's hard to come by these days, especially on TV. That's where we come in. Salem News Channel has the greatest collection of conservative minds all in one place. People you know and trust, like Dennis Prager, Eric Metaxas, Charlie Kirk, and more. Unfiltered, unapologetic truth. Find what you're searching for at snc.tv and on Local Now Channel 525.